My name's Evan. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you all very much for having me this evening. Sam invited me. Sam did a wonderful job as a speaker for the symposium that my group holds each December back in Charlottesville, and in what I called a savvy AA veteran move immediately after he did the speaker. And I told him what a good job he did. He said, well, why don't you come speak at my group? So I was kind of locked in, but I've been looking forward to it. My sobriety date is December 15th, 2012. So I picked up my five-year medallion just a couple of weeks ago. So this invitation was very timely for me because every year around my anniversary time, I start to think back on sort of what the journey has been, you know, both with drinking and then getting sober. And I usually find that those thoughts are helpful in preparing for opportunities to speak like this. I feel like I'm kind of continually sorting through and sifting through the experiences that I had in getting sober and trying to make sense of it. And this is one of the ways that I do that, so I'm very grateful to have been asked. So let's see. I'm 30 years old, just turned 30 years old. I guess I'll start with, you know, how it was. You know, neither of my parents were alcoholics. My mother is in the rooms now, but she didn't drink at all, really, the entire time that I was growing up. My dad was a businessman. He traveled a lot. So I was pretty much in a one-parent household, five to seven days a week. And, you know, I never saw my mom drink or overdo it. Maybe I've seen my dad drink too much once, so I didn't feel like there was really any. By the time I got old enough to be concerned about this, I didn't feel like there was really any genetic predisposition towards alcoholism in my family. And more than that, I had no experience with it. You know, I hadn't ever really seen the damage that alcoholism could do to a family. I kind of learned later that some of my extended relatives were alcoholics and that some of them had done some things that really screwed up their lives. I had an uncle who, you know, had a very promising business career, was just doing great things as a young executive, and then had a DUI in which he accidentally killed someone, and you know, had a manslaughter charge, and that he was pretty much unemployable after that. But all of these things sort of happened in the periphery of my childhood, so I didn't really know what to expect, or you know, even if I had known, I'm not sure that that. In fact, I know that it wouldn't have dissuaded me from moving down the path if I did. But as it relates to alcoholism, the biggest thing that I think about and recall about my childhood was always feeling like a bit of an outsider. You know, I always had friends and, you know, decently good at sports and school. I didn't really have any particular reason to feel like I was defective, but that's just the way that I always felt. It seemed to me that there were things that everyone else knew how to do that I always had to learn after the fact, that other people had, you know, gotten the book on life and, you know, I hadn't gotten my copy and had to kind of try and emulate what other people were doing, particularly as it relates to friendships and relationships. I had a lot of false starts and screw ups and, you know, trying to learn as I go. So I don't actually think that, you know, after getting sober and talking this over a lot with a therapist and with my sponsor, I actually don't think that people ever sought to ostracize me or make me feel like that. I actually think that people used to try and tease me to bring me into the group. You know, it's just one of the ways that kids relate to each other. But when you have low self-esteem, or when I had low self-esteem and, you know, felt like people were doing that, everything felt like an attack, you know, even sometimes when it was an invitation. And so as a result of that, you know, I went through elementary school, middle school, and high school kind of holding myself apart from people, not realizing it, but, you know, in retrospect, I can see that that's the way it happened. And so I think I had my first drink when I was 14 or 15, probably when I was like a freshman in high school. And I'd always been interested in drinking, but, you know, I thought that it was a cool thing to do. The other kids were into it, so I thought, you know, maybe it'd be a fun thing to do with other people. And as soon as I tried it, you know, I'd stolen some man, this was such a vivid taste memory. I think it was peach schnapps from my grandfather. It's really awful. I drank all that, and, you know, I just felt like I had found the solution to this hole that I had, like this feeling that I needed to be accepted and validated from the other kids my age, but, you know, I could never get that. When I drank and some of that anxiety started to melt away, I felt like I could really relate to people And more than that, that people were just fascinating. You know, there was nothing I liked better than just getting drunk and having a conversation with someone and really listening to what they were saying, which, you know, I couldn't really do when I was sober. I was too self-interested and anxious to really engage with people that way. But, you know, I started drinking and overdid it the very first time, and I don't think I ever really drank in moderation after that. There were times when I didn't drink enough to get sick, but that was because something awful happened. Like, my sister was in a car wreck and I had to stop drinking to go do something else. Or we ran out of alcohol. Like, I had drunk everything in the house and there was nothing else for me to drink. There was never a circumstance where, you know, I had a couple of beers, like I've seen, you know, my wife do or other people do. And, you know, that's pretty much the way it was from 15 through the end of high school, just turning the knob to 11. Like, every time I got involved with drugs or alcohol, it always felt a little like a science experiment. You know, like, I wonder, you know, 10 feels pretty good. I wonder what happened if I took, like, two more shots right away and just, you know, see what – and there was also an element of, like, probability to it, of risk-taking. You know, who knows what will happen if I just put all this in my body and then I'm going to watch and see what the result is. And I think I grew to be addicted to that part of it too, is that sense of, you know, anything could happen and maybe it'll be a great thing. Although it almost never was. It felt great for a little while, but not in the long run. And in high school, I grew to be kind of infamous for my exploits when I was drinking, which added to my feeling like an outsider. You know, everyone would all be drinking together. You know, we'd have a few beers. Everything would be great. And then I'd start drinking more and more, and people would goad me into doing stuff that was really risky or stupid. And I, you know, at first felt kind of bad about doing that, but then felt like that was just my role. You know, that was my opportunity to – that was the role I needed to play in the group that I was in. So that led to a lot of embarrassing Monday mornings at school and things like that. But you know, through it all, I was a pretty good student, and I did well on my test scores, so I knew that I'd be going to college. I ended up going to school about like 20 or 25 minutes away from my home. I was raised in Franklin, Tennessee, which is like 20 minutes south of Nashville. So I went to school in Nashville, and I kind of squeaked in off the wait list. You know, I had expected to have some really good choices for school. And I suppose I did, but not as many as I felt like I deserved. And the school that I went to wasn't one of my targets or anything like that. So I kind of went in with like a chip on my shoulder, and I skipped the orientation. And you know, I think the very first few days that we were there, they had set up like a not charity, but like a volunteer type event, just to get the kids like engaged in the community, and you know, sort of a bonding thing. And I blew all that off, and then I, you know, basically anything that I didn't feel like I absolutely had to be at, I just skipped, which led to, once again, this cycle of feeling like an outsider and then seeking to deal with that with drugs and alcohol. So, and you'll see why this matters. My very first semester, I think I had like a 3.5 GPA, and then my second semester I had a 2.9. And then my third semester, I had a 1.9. And then my fourth semester, I had a 0.6. It was capped off with a class I took called The Meaning of Life, which I failed. And it was a philosophy class. And I always felt like that was just my drinking in a microcosm. You know, I just was not effective in any part of my life when I was drinking or using. And I especially couldn't divine the meaning of life. I certainly didn't know it. As far as I was concerned, the meaning of life was to just cram as much pleasure into a day as I could and to use people as instruments and screw them over, you know, whenever I was trying to accumulate resources or respect or anything else. I couldn't really understand ethics or trying to treat people well at all. And in fact, you know, I always tell this because I think it's a very good piece of perspective on where I was emotionally. I remember they used to give out these awards for community service in high school. And every time they gave it out, I remember thinking to myself, like, what a bunch of suckers. You know, these people have been conned into going and working for free for whatever this cause is. And, you know, some people, why are we celebrating that? You know, that doesn't seem, I couldn't imagine that there was any reward to volunteering your time for someone else. Just didn't make any sense to me. I felt sorry for the people that were getting the awards. which I probably should have had a conversation with one of them. Maybe they could have steered me right. But, you know, just morally and emotionally and spiritually bankrupt, just no sense of perspective in the world. I was always first. Didn't really care about anyone else. Didn't really have any friends. You know, I had people who would hang around me if I had, you know, money for drugs or alcohol or that type of thing, but nobody that I could really say I had their back and they had mine. And I wasn't deserving of friendship in the state that I was in. I was a danger to myself and others. So anyhow, at the end of those four semester slide, which included, you know, less and less academics and more drugs and alcohol through the entire thing, the provost of the school called me into their office and said, you know, we're dismissing you from the school. And I kind of knew this was going to happen. They had sent some email or letter that was like cryptic, but I sort of knew what was happening. So I remember riding the elevator up and sitting down with her and her saying, you know, this is what's going to happen. And we're kicking you. Shouldn't say kicking you out. She's too polite. She said, you're going to be dismissed for academic deficiency, but we'll let you back in a year if you make good use of your time. And immediately, the thought, you know, I was seized with the thought that I've got to do something amazing during this time. Like, I had all these delusions of grandeur that I would, like, write a novel or, you know, go work in a fishing boat in Alaska or something to find myself. And I shared some of these plans with my parents, and who had paid quite a bit of money for me to go to school there and basically, you know, ruin the chance. And, you know, my dad said something to me. He's just like, Evan, you don't need to, you know, if you want to do any of that stuff, I think that's great, but that's not what you need to do. What you really need to do is figure out how to do your work before you do your play. You know, he hadn't yet gotten to the point where he was willing to say, you have an alcohol problem or a drug problem, and you need to stop doing that. His perspective was, I don't care if you do that stuff, but you just have to do your homework first, which I think is a remarkable way to parent. That's probably, like, you know, probably the most charitable way to deal with an alcoholic kid. I would have been so furious if I were him. But so anyway, I spent that year I quit smoking marijuana and using other drugs, reasoning that that was the real trouble. I mean, the drinking was not the reason that I was doing so poorly. It was the drugs. And then I worked in a restaurant, two restaurants actually. And then I knew someone through the golf club where I used to play golf, who let me come into his office. He was an attorney, and I would work with him, you know, 1 or 2 days a week. And I did the restaurant work, and I realized that I hated it and didn't want to do it for the rest of my life, and that I'd been given a great opportunity to go to school and use my brain to make money instead of, you know, my back or my hands. And then I went to the lawyer's office and thought, you know, this guy seems like he's got a pretty good life. I mean, he drives a BMW 7 Series. He's old, but people seem to still respect him and listen to what he has to say. He has a nice family. And so I decided I'd better become an attorney. That was the way forward for me. So I got him to write me, or I asked him, got him, old manipulative language, isn't it? I asked him to write a letter, and he said yes to the school to get me back in, you know, saying that I'd done a good job for him over the past year. And I had to totally reapply to college. And, of course, this whole thing was quite the embarrassment and the scandal in my friend group. I mean, I was one of a group of, like, 20 or 30 people that all kind of saw each other on a daily or weekly basis and all lived together. And then suddenly I was gone, and all my plans to room with people were disrupted, and I'm sure it caused them some problems. But anyway, after that year was over, I got back into school. And from then on, I did very well in school. I think I had, like, a 3.9 from then on. That was the only way that I was doing any better. You know, the drinking just got worse and worse, to the point where I could only take classes after, like, 12 because I was so hungover. I couldn't even get out of bed before then every day on a weekly basis. I just knew if I sign up for that class, I'll never make it. You know, I'll get an F because I just can't get up and get it done. So I sort of limped my way through college. And I knew I wanted to go to law school, but I couldn't get in to the school I wanted to go to with the grades I had. So I had to take another year off after when school. I graduated, and then Yeah, I'll tell the story of my graduation because I think about this too. Got super drunk with my friend the night before, and then I insisted that he drive me home, but I wouldn't tell him the way. So he eventually got sick of that and left me in a field in the car. Drunk drove my way home, slept for like 2 or 3 hours, and then woke up, and on the way to my graduation, I stopped and got some liquor so that I could drink in the car on the way there. And then I started drinking that as I was like trying to find a parking space for my graduation. And of course I had a lot of family and people in town. And immediately, as soon as I took a sip of the liquor, I just threw up in the passenger seat of the car. Just the memory of that, I think, will never leave me, because then I had to get out and go do the graduation the entire time knowing that there, you know, my vomit was just sitting in the car. Super hot day. It's just really unpleasant. That's just the way things were. It's like I had these disasters, and even the things that were supposed to be good in my life were terrible, because I felt like I had this wound that would never heal, you know, this sickness that I couldn't make any progress with. And the vomiting incident, I think, is just a physical manifestation of that emotional and spiritual condition that I was in. But I worked a job for a year, and alcoholism just got worse and worse. You know, I have fewer friends than ever, fewer people who would even come out and drink with me, to skip back. I also had some brushes with the law in college, just a couple of alcohol intoxication tickets, but it ended up being a big problem when I was applying to school to have this criminal record. Which makes not that much sense, because there's plenty of very unethical attorneys, but they try and use it as a way to weed people out. So once again, I was in a situation where I had to try and squeak through something I didn't quite have the credentials for. But all this stuff happened, and I got to apply to law school here in Charlottesville. And, you know, somehow or another, I got into the school, and I decided that I moved here and I'd turn over a new leaf. You know, I was going to stop drinking the way I had been. I was 23 then. So I'd been drinking for, you know, 8 or 9 years, and it had become clear to me that I needed to, sorry to keep backtracking, but I only do this like once every 2 years, so I don't have it all in perfect order. But I had gotten these alcohol intoxication tickets, and I didn't have any money to deal with them, really. So I had to tell my parents about it to borrow the money. And they insisted that I go to a counselor for alcoholism as a condition of them loaning me the money to deal with these issues, the legal issues. And the counselor I went to is actually really great. He, I think, has been sober for like 20 or 25 years. And I was extremely distrustful of going to him, because he operated out of a church. Just that was enough to turn me off. You know, completely forget the fact that he was a specialist in this problem that I had. I didn't like the location of his office, so I couldn't be bothered to go. But I went there, and every time I went, you know, I'd basically sit there and lie to him for like 55 minutes about how little I had drunk that week and like how well everything was going. And this man was just so patient and wise. He would just listen to all that. And I think at the time I thought I was fooling him, but now I realize probably wasn't. You know, when I deal with alcoholics now who are lying to me about how much they're drinking, it's pretty obvious. But then at the end of each session, he would just say, well, you know, I think maybe you could benefit from going to an AA meeting. And he would walk over to the computer and print me out a little list of AA meetings in the area and hand it to me and just say, you know, if you want to, think it could help. And, you know, I would always express some interest in it or act like I was going to go, but I always secretly had the plan to just blow it off. And that's what I did. And this went on for probably like 6 months. And he would just keep, you know, politely suggesting that maybe there was something there for me. And I would keep agreeing with him and then deciding not going to do it this week. So anyway, that was kind of the background. That's the only real experience I had with AA before the next chapter, but that sort of sets the stage. So I came here at 23, and I thought, all right, I'm turning over a new leaf on drinking. I'm not going to drink, you know, at all during the week. And I'd tried stuff like this before, but I felt like I was, you know, moving into a new stage in life where I was more responsible, and that it was going to work this time. And so I I found myself a new roommate down the road from the law school, and I think like we were there for maybe 2 weeks before school started. And within like a week of getting there, someone had thrown a party down the road, you know, just a walk from my little area. And I went down there and immediately felt intimidated and scared of my classmates. Like, all these people are so accomplished. They really seem to have a handle on things. They've got all these experiences. You know, none of them seem to have gotten kicked out of college. All these negative feelings of being an outsider, which I tried to assuage by drinking a lot of the beer that they had there. And my poor, sweet Midwestern roommate, a super nice guy, never deserved a room with me, ended up having to carry me back to the room like within like 3 or 4 days of my meeting him. I'm sure he was terrified about what the semester would entail. But, you know, the point was that I had gone to that party with every intention of not drinking. You know, I had told this plan to my girlfriend, to my roommate, to my family, and it just fell apart. Like, the slightest bit of pressure, I just completely crumbled. I didn't have any other way to deal with negative feelings besides to drink. So from then on, you know, kind of got worse and worse, stopped going to class, stopped doing the readings. In law school, they do something called cold calling, where they will just pick one of you like at random in the audience and ask you a question. You may have seen it in like the paper chase or something. And you know, I just performed like so badly in those because I had never done any of the work that I needed to do. I'd never read anything that they're asking me about. And you couldn't just say like, well, I guess you could have, and I probably should have just said, well, I didn't read it, so I'm not prepared. But I wouldn't do that. I'd try and fake my way through it. When the, you know, that annoys the teacher, so then they kind of, you know, have fun at your expense and poke fun at your how dumb you are, how poorly you answer the question. And after that, I really felt like the other kids or the other students were not out to get me, but just sort of condescending towards me. And that was all the fuel I needed to just go on, you know, the biggest drunken binge that I'd done at that point of just like probably 2 months of really good, solid drinking, not leaving my room for a lot of it. And unfortunately, like in law school, all the exams are at the end of the semester. You can't do any work. I mean, you can work, but you don't get any grades before the very end. So I kept just procrastinating and reasoning that like other things that I'd had success with in the past, I would just cram the information at the end of the period. And, you know, that's what I tried to do. And it sort of worked okay for two of the exams. And then I had, you know, not quite a mental breakdown, but I just couldn't. I couldn't retain any more information in my brain. Like it was just like a catastrophic failure of memory and focus. And that really made me feel strange because that had never happened before. And I started feeling like I was going to fail the exam. Like this was hopeless. I'm going to get kicked out of school. So I took the my contract exam and then went out and just started drinking. And I didn't have a clear plan about what I was going to do, but I knew I was going to drink until I passed out, and then I would sort out what to do about criminal procedure the next day. And I ended up drinking like at the corner of Charlottesville. I don't know. This is all pieced together from like bank statements and the police report. But I was just drinking down there for a while at several different establishments, like got in a fight or two, and then tried to drunk drive home. I think on Wortland Avenue they got me. But anyhow, I had like hit a car that was fortunately not, you know, oncoming. I hit like a car that was parallel parked and tore off like part of the bumper, which was then in my bumper, like rotating and hitting the ground for like another 150 yards. And then I passed out with like my foot on the brake in the middle of the street. And that's the way the police officer found me. And I sort of recall, like, you know, there being flashing lights and, like, someone trying to bang on the window to wake me up. And I guess I was being, like, sort of, I was being rude to the officer and belligerent. And so they, you know, cuffed me and put me in the back of one of those, like, paddy wagons, kind of like The Wire or something. I'd never seen one around here. And took me on a nice little drive around Charlottesville at high speeds and did some big corners. So I was pretty banged up, and then they took me to the hospital, and I refused to have blood drawn, and was just a very negative interaction, I think, for both sides. You know, they hated me, and, you know, I was drunk. So, anyhow. So I woke up that day, the next day, in the Albemarle County Jail, and I had no idea where I was or what I had done to get there. I mean, for all I knew, I had killed someone. You know, I had no, that was my first thought, is I've killed someone. And so I came kind of up to the cells and asked them, like, why am I in jail? Like, what happened? And they told me, well, they wouldn't tell me at first, which, like, really scared me. But then eventually they told me that I had gotten picked up on DWI. And I just had this, like, I remember trying to cultivate this false bravado about it. Like, oh, just a DWI, no big deal. Like, can you let me out now? Like, but inside I kind of felt this feeling like, oh no, it finally happened. You know, I'd never had a DWI before. Several of my friends had. And I think part of me always thought that, you know, whenever that happens, that's when I'll know I really need to make a change. I'm not sure why I felt that way, but I just knew that it was really bad. It was going to really screw up my opportunities at school, and that, you know, I was in a deep mess. So they finally let me out, and I walked back to school, and back to my house, which was next to school from the jail. It took about like 2 hours, and I just remember walking along that road and just thinking, like, as every car passed me, like, they somehow knew what had happened. And that, you know, it was just so apparent that I was screwing up and that I was, you know, drunk and hungover and trying to walk down this road. I didn't have my stuff and, like, I don't know. I was just a mess. And, like, every car that passed me, I was more and more embarrassed. It was just, like, everything that I had done was, like, on display for anyone to walk past and drive past and see. And I guess that, you know, that was pretty much true. So I went home and I had a letter or an email from the dean where they had said, you know, I heard you got in a bit of trouble last night. And, you know, I called them and, you know, right away said, you know I screwed up. And I wasn't sure exactly like how I was going to play it. You know, I wasn't sure whether I was going to try and downplay it, say this is just a one-time thing, or whether I was really going to get honest about the other scrapes I've had with alcohol and how I just couldn't seem to get on top of it. I decided I would defer judgment on that until I saw what would work better and what would get me into the least amount of trouble. But anyhow, I went in and met with them, and, you know, they asked if I could take the rest of my exams, and I realize now that that was probably an actual option to not take the exams, and that probably would have been helpful. But at the time, I just said, yeah, of course, I'll take them. So I ended up doing really poorly. And the other piece of this is, like, my girlfriend was supposed to come live with me after the first semester. But then this happened, like, probably like 2 or 3 weeks before she was coming. So that was like a really hard conversation to have, to call her up and be like, you know, I just got a DUI, and that threw all of her plans into disarray. And I'd been dating this woman at that point for, I don't know, like 3 years. And this was a pretty big event to move in together that, you know, I'd been sort of scraping to get towards. But she was, you know, understandably very reticent because of the drinking. But so at that point, I didn't know what I was going to do. You know, I was pretty sure I was going to get dismissed from school, or at least, you know, suspended for the second time, second school. You know, I had this, my car was destroyed, at least, you know, the front half of it. I got this terrible record of alcohol-related offenses that's pretty plain to anyone looking at my criminal record that, you know, this is a deeply troubled person. I didn't think I'd be able to get a job. I was just screwing up. So anyhow, I went home for the Christmas holiday and kind of told my parents what had happened, and they didn't really know what to say. I mean, I think they had said at that point everything that they had in their arsenal to deal with a kid who was alcoholic. You know, I remember my dad sitting me down once and being like, well, you know, something I do is, if you have a drink, then I just have a glass of water. And if you do that, you never really get too drunk. And that was his solution. I mean, and that's what works for him. So, I mean, yeah, it's just like two people not really able to communicate on that issue. That just made me take like twice as many trips to the bathroom. It didn't slow down the drinking. So what happened next? I could just sort of doped around the entire Christmas break, feeling depressed and not sure what to do. I told my parents that I would go to an AA meeting when I got back to Charlottesville. And then, fortunately, the person whose car I hit contacted me, and I was able to make that right with them. I'm actually amazed that that all worked out, because I think I got probably pretty close in the vicinity of an amends without knowing it. You know, I was able to pay to have the car fixed and get them a rental car. It was a UVA student. And then I had, they called me up on, the student disciplinary board, and I had to appear before that. But anyhow, the way it all sorted out is they were going to let me come back to school conditioned on I was basically on a type of probation, and I had to get help with my alcohol problem. You know, that was the first time I'd ever had it sort of in writing that I had an alcohol problem. And I think people tried to avoid putting it down on my record. But anyhow, that's what happened. And I came back and started I went to a psychologist, and he diagnosed me with social anxiety and in the context of alcoholism or something like that. I would just call it alcoholism. And I went to my first AA meeting, which was at the they discontinued it now, but it's like a halfway house or a sober living house in Charlottesville. I can't remember what it's called now. It's still there, but they discontinued the meeting. And first I tried to go to another meeting. I tried to go to the St. Paul's meeting on the corner, and I got there, and I was the withdrawal from alcohol was a big part of it. But I was so nervous and anxious that I couldn't find the entrance to the church. Like, I walked around the church two times and couldn't find the door. And there's six doors there, so that tells you what kind of state that I was in. I couldn't figure out how to get into the meeting and where people were, and then I was going to be 15 minutes late, and I was horrified about that. And so I just started crying, and I remember calling my parents and being like, "Yeah, I went to the meeting and it was pretty good," and just feeling so rotten about that, because I had the intention to go to the meeting, but I couldn't even do that. I was just such a mess. But then I finally went to my real first meeting, which was at, as I said, the halfway house. And I went in the back. They had a little meeting set up in the back. And I got there way early and sat by myself. But I definitely still stuck out. And people started sharing, and a lot of what they shared about had to do with crack cocaine. I wouldn't blink an eye at that now, but at the time I was just like, "Oh, well, this is not for me. It's totally separate. This is a crack cocaine group." And I just stopped listening. You know, the entire time I started thinking about myself, thinking about, how I was going to lie about this meeting and how helpful it was to try and get back on track. And then I left, and on the way out, this young guy kind of grabbed my arm and was just like, "Hey, what's your name?" And I introduced myself to him, and I wanted to leave, but he sort of forced me to have the conversation with him. His name was Jesse, and we talked for two or three minutes, and he said he'd been sober for a few years and that if I ever, wanted to talk more, I could call him. And he gave me his number, and I didn't intend on ever calling it or communicating with him. But a few days later, he texted me and just said, "Hey, it's nice to meet you the other night. Once again, I'm Jesse." And from there, we started chatting a little bit. We ended up, going to a couple more meetings together. And he told me sort of about sponsorship and how stuff worked. And I asked him to be my sponsor. And, I wish I could say that I came into this meeting or came into this group with a genuine desire to get sober. I really don't know that I did. I think I felt like I would come here for appearances for a while, and if I made enough of an improvement, I would discontinue and just go back to doing what I wanted. I said, I'll give it a try. I felt like at this point I had no other options. I didn't have anything to lose. I basically screwed up every other opportunity that I had, and I was on the verge of screwing up this opportunity and having to begin another career. So I said I'd meet him for pancakes, which is what he suggested. And I remember thinking, what the hell does that have to do with alcoholism? This is deadly serious. We don't need to be eating pancakes together. I hope you got something better. But we ate the pancakes, and he kind of said, if we work together, here's what I expect. And it was simple stuff. You know, go to 4 meetings a week. Don't lie to me. You know, do what you say, what you're going to do. Work the steps. I'll give you an assignment every week. You come back. You have to get a notebook and, you know, bring a pencil. I mean, it was the type of stuff that I would have been tasked with, like, as an elementary school or middle school student. And that didn't engender, like, a great deal of confidence either. But I said I'd do it, and we started working together. And I frankly, for that first few months, I couldn't do anything in life besides go to my classes and sort of pay attention and write down what they said and play video games by myself in my house. The idea of going out into public and dealing with people, even having like a transaction like buying food, was so stressful that I just didn't know how to handle it without alcohol. So I was a bit of a recluse, but I would go to the meetings for a week. I think I actually went to more than that for a while. I think I did like 75 and 90 or something. And I would meet with them, and we kind of worked through the steps. 1, 2, and 3 were not a big deal. I told them that I didn't believe in God, but that I'd use the AA group as my higher power. And I intended that to be like sort of a showdown, like, well, I'm not going to do what you say, but I'll do this. And he was just like, that's fine, and, you know, move on to 4. And that was like a big letdown. Like, I had hoped that we'd have like a nice fight about that and I could delay my progress with the steps. But he just kept me moving. And I made a list of all my resentments, which filled many, many pages. I think that the biggest indication that I had that that process was helpful to me and produced some growth in me is that by the time I was done with the list, the ones at the start seemed dumb. You know, they seemed like resentments that were foolish to have and that I ought to let go of. And I think that's probably the strongest thing I can say about that, is that even in the probably spent 3 weeks on it. From week 1 to week 3, I was able to see this is stupid that I'm letting this control my life or make me feel negative. I ought to just get rid of this one. But, you know, he didn't let me just cross him off. We went through all the rest of the 4-step. And just kind of went on from there. I'm immensely grateful to Jesse for having, you know, grabbed my arm and forced me to introduce myself to him. That's something that I really don't do enough of in AA. You know, I always think about it's a program of attraction, not promotion. And, you know, that's the case. But when you read the big book, or when I do, there's a lot of, like, pretty aggressive 12-step work in there. And I was the beneficiary of that on Jesse's part. So what it's like now, I got my legal stuff sorted out, pled guilty to the DWI, which means I'll never be a politician, but I didn't really get in that much trouble. It was nice. It didn't prevent me from becoming an attorney. I also got involved in a group called Lawyers Helping Lawyers, which is a great program for lawyers, judges, and law students who are dealing with alcoholism or drug abuse. And they assign you a mentor who's not really a sponsor, but just another lawyer to sort of keep tabs on you. You submit every month like a list of meetings you've been to. And I was on a drug testing program, although I was never doing drugs in the last, you know, at the time that this was all going on. Just a few other things like that. But started working with Jesse. Things immediately, I'll say this, every part of my life from the time I stopped drinking or from the time I started coming to AA and doing what everyone told me to do, improved, like across the board. My relationships with my family that had been so strained for years suddenly started to not be fully repaired, but they were glad to have me around again, you know, whereas before I was a constant source of worry and frustration. I had put myself in a bit of a hole academically with my first semester's performance, and I did a lot better my second semester and for the rest of law school, to the point where I ended up finishing around like the middle to top third of the class. And after the first semester, I was in like the bottom fourth. So that was a huge relief. Before my girlfriend, now wife, moved here, I found a community of people in AA, other young people that I could go out and do things with without drinking. Things that in the past I would have like snorted at and been like, that sounds terrible. I don't want to go sober bowling, or I don't want to go to a movie without drinking beforehand. It just sounded terrible to me. But I grew to appreciate that. And I think for some people, the fellowship aspect is a really big part of getting sober. It was for me a little bit, but for me, like, the number one thing that helped me get sober and that keeps me sober is just reading the big book. You know, that's kind of how I process things, is like I read and then I think about it. And I'm in a home group that reads the big book, you know, every Wednesday, the Preambers group. And that's been a really big part of my recovery, is that, you know, the belief that the answers to my problems are in here. And when I have something that's troubling me, like if I haven't read this through or read the appropriate section, I don't even call my sponsor about it until I've had a look at this and either need more direction or, you know, want to double check what I think I found. So that's kind of been my North Star as far as my sobriety goes. And the gifts that this program have brought, as I said, have stretched across every avenue of life, every part of my life. I honestly don't think, since I was a kid, that I was ever genuinely happy for anyone else until I got sober. If somebody had something good happen to them, I was resentful or envious, and I felt scared because they had something that I didn't have. And, you know, now I either had to get it or I had to get something better to feel okay. And that feeling has gone away. You know, when good things happen to people, I'm happy for them. And, you know, that almost felt like seeing a new color or something like that. It's just a totally foreign feeling that seemed to come out of nowhere just by doing this stuff. And, you know, I developed something called a conscience, they tell me. You know, when I do things that don't sit right with me, instead of just, like, crushing them as small as I can and putting them in the back of my head, you know, I try and make it right as soon as it happens. The amends process has been a really healing process for me. I still have more to go, but the biggest ones that have been weighing on me most heavily, I was able to knock out. And the thing that's really important for me with doing those is writing out on a note card ahead of time what I'm going to say. Because if I'm given any opportunity to equivocate or to offer an excuse or to push any part of the blame on the other person, it's like an instinct. I'll just jump for it. So my sponsor makes me write out exactly what I'm going to say on the note card. And I sit there and read it, and it feels kind of foolish. And I can tell it always makes the other person uncomfortable. But I tell myself that they'd be a lot more uncomfortable if I said what I actually wanted to say, which is, you know, the only reason I did this is because you did that. And so, you know, that's my experience with that. I've had the good fortune to sponsor a couple of other guys since I've been in the program. I guess I just got started with one guy, like, after I'd been sober, like, 2 years or so. And, you know, a couple come in and out since then. There's guys that, you know, are sober today that I've worked with, and there's guys that are not. And, you know, I don't think either of those is more valuable to them or to me. Like, I just hope that the guys that aren't in the program now, that they're not going to look back at the work that we did together and use it as an excuse not to come back. You know, when I think about the relationship that I had with that psychologist back in Nashville, like 10 years ago, the thing about it is, like, he didn't solve my problem, but he didn't scare me away. You know, there was nothing I could point to and say, well, I'm not going back to AA because that guy was pushy. You know, he just said, maybe there's something for you there. And that made it a lot easier for me to come back to these rooms. Because the last thing I needed was to erect more roadblocks between me and, you know, the solution, the spiritual solution that we have here. I'd say the biggest problem, maybe I'll end kind of on this direction. The biggest problem that I deal with on a day-to-day basis is drifting into a mindset of entitlement, that I've somehow earned this, that, like, through my hard work and dedication, I'm sober today, and that any part of this is attributable to my efforts or my power. And that's exactly the wrong way to look at this, as far as I'm concerned. Nothing that I could think of or could execute on my own had any positive effect on my drinking. All of my plans, all of my efforts made things worse. made the drinking worse and made my life worse. So the idea that, you know, by going to these meetings and talking to people that I've done enough, that my contribution is sufficient to stay sober, is a really dangerous perspective for me. Along with that, this feeling of like entitlement is sometimes the temptation to let my guard down or to ease up a little bit. If it's cold outside, well, maybe just won't go to the meeting tonight, make it up later in the week. Well, maybe I won't make it up because I'm feeling pretty good today. Those are the thoughts that I deal with. And not always, but, you know, enough of the time that it's something I need to put a system in place to deal with. And the way I did that is through my sponsor's suggestion of just making things a habit. You know, I don't like going up to new people at a meeting and introducing myself and asking them how they're doing. It's uncomfortable for me, but I just make it a habit that I do that when I see newcomers at the meeting. Before I can really think about it and decide whether or not to do it, I just go for it. And that's been successful for me in doing things that I don't want to do. I don't know that I had one good habit before I got sober, only bad ones. But my sponsor said, you know, if somebody asks you to do service, just say yes. Always introduce yourself to new people. Talk about the solution, not the problems in your life, as much as you can. And that's been effective for me. Sometimes the other piece of it that I think about in relationship to like what I've done versus what my higher power has done is that early on in sobriety, like every day I felt extremely grateful to be alive, particularly for the first like year or two. And now I have that feeling sometimes, but it doesn't come to me automatically. I feel like I have to do more work for it. But it's such a good feeling that I don't necessarily mind that. Every once in a while I'll have it, you know, if I'm walking somewhere and see like some sunlight in the trees or something, it's really pretty. And, you know, I'm reminded about all the risks that I took with my life, and just be glad to be alive. But more often it comes when it has something to do with AA, when I'm in a really good meeting or hear a really good speaker, or sit down with somebody else across the table with pancakes. And I'm able to tell them this is what worked for me. And then when they leave the meeting that I have with them, sometimes you can see people just feel a little lighter. You know, there's like a spring in their step or their sense of some type of hope, that there, maybe I've got something for them with this problem, which is, you know, the way I felt when after I'd eaten my pancakes. And so sometimes when that's not enough, I think, well, you know, I really owe it to the people that I wronged, you know, my mom and dad who brought me into this world, and then I treated terribly for the first 23 years, maybe more. I'm not sure. I was like, yeah, I mean, after I got sober, I still had some learning to do, but, you know, or my girlfriend, now wife, like I've got to make things right by her. And the first building block in that is staying sober. And, sometimes even when that's not doing it for me, I start thinking about like people I lost along the way. You know, either guys who I used to drink with and are still out there drinking, or people who like never quite made it, you know, people who just moved on to other stuff that they're not going to get back from, I'm pretty sure, or who died, you know, from this disease or something like it. And I don't think I'm more deserving. In fact, like compared to a lot of people that I knew who've passed away from this or something like it, I'm less deserving. You know, I did things that they would never have done because they had a more active conscience when they were drinking and using than I did. But, you know, they're gone now and I'm still here. So I just try and make the best use of my time that I can on a daily basis. Thanks a lot for letting me share. Yeah.